So Francine, I only watched about a minute of that Ron Doss.
No, it was ridiculous.
I mean, I can't believe they didn't cut out the first 13 minutes.
It was like, I know.
Why put that on YouTube?
You have to get past all the stoners making
It was like
things in the camera.
Moving the chairs around.
They were actually going up in the camera just going.
it was really dumb.
They're a bunch of stoners.
What were you getting out of that?
Nothing. It was just for one comment. I don't know. I went on some weird, because Pat posted the blue pancake guy to the lawyer group, and then I looked him up, like I watched that video, and then somehow I ended up on some Ram Dass, you know, YouTube. Next thing you know, you're in fucking another world doing dumb shit.
Look up Ram Dass, Terrence McKenna. Because they had a meeting. It was kind of interesting.
Right.
It wasn't great. It was interesting.
Anyway, what was funny, though, it was kind of this bizarre random progression of the three that I sent out was, like, the new agey. Like, I just, it was, like, obvious that guy, the blue pancake guy, is, like, a sorcerer. And he had Ram Dass confused, thinking he knew more than he did, because he's still in the new agey. Like, everybody that, like, a sorcerer can dupe them so easily. They're like, oh, he must have something I don't have, and I just can't get down with it, you know?
You think Ram Dass was thinking, is that what you mean?
That's kind of the way they behaved, I thought, yeah.
Yeah.
And,
Poor Ram Dass.
And then the man of knowledge, Krishnamurti, is just like, no. Take meditation and shove it up your ass.
Yeah, you ruined meditation forever for me. I used to actually kind of sit pretty, not religiously or anything, but I would sit for longer periods of time and I sort of can't. Because that thought arrives, keep doing absolutely fucking nothing. Just start your day. I get up and shower for it. I used to be able to procrastinate really well from work that way. I was doing something. Procrastinating for more.
Oh, no, really, the best quote, the most succinct. Yeah, I just want to say stuck.
Most sucky quote.
It's not a one-liner from the porch talk. Just be a real loser.
Yeah.
I just keep standing to myself and laughing. Just go ahead and be a real loser.
Okay. That's the succinct quote?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's good. It's really good. Because there's this kind of thing that keeps popping up seemingly that's like wants to become, wants to do something, wants to be somebody. Just be a real loser.
Be an ass. Don't be a half-ass.
Well, it is kind of like the Superman thing in some way. Like, he walks around like a bumbling loser moron in human world, and he doesn't care because he knows he needs to give a shit, you know?
it's hard to avoid the pride of deliverance.
Of any kind of deliverance, I guess. From culture.
Yeah. Let's see, I'll feign Dark Night of the Soul, then I'll go see some half-assed spiritual teacher, and they'll give me some advice, and then I'll pretend that I've had an enlightenment breakthrough, and then I'll use all the right language and write a book and put that on my website, and then I can count myself amongst the delivered.
Do you really think it's that conscious? I think it's just... Actually, I don't know what it is, but I don't know if it's that conscious. I think there's people out there that really think they have it, whether they do or not.
I think there's a understanding of the duping somewhere in there. You know, may not
just pointing out more the geometry of how it may occur rather than whether or not they think they're doing anything consciously or not consciously.
Yeah, it's just it's the formula.
Yeah.
You look at the formula that's reinforced by enlightened person interview shows. And, you know, the sentimentality of their life story and when they were a seeker and marvelous spiritual experiences and waves of despair and giving up and being too late to the game, having a catharsis or a breakthrough or something that sounds like a enlightened visitation of the soul, and then a life now lived spontaneously, abundantly, joyously, enviably by you fucking losers. It's like, what am I supposed to do? The formula always reinforces the human, call it principles of the interviewer and the human now enviable lifestyle of the interviewee and the, you know, bump that your website or ministry is going to receive now that you've been invited to be interviewed on such and such a show.
I wonder if there's any way out. I mean, now I think we have a way out here. But, I mean, there's not many ways out. I mean, it seems back out, so that's like a word, you know.
The
and just about anything that you tune in.
Yeah?
No refinement.
Yeah? You know, deliverance, or the envying deliverance, someone else's deliverance, only becomes attractive by virtue of the ways in which one has imagined they have or are suffering. Yeah. Right? So, we can't stand it anymore. We can't stand ourselves anymore. Our moods, our thoughts, our isolation, you know, the repetition of the way we think and feel about things. So that's me again. So it sounds like if, you know, Bart Marshall or Bart Simpson got enlightened through one or other efforts or non-efforts that, golly gee, Batman, I'd really like that to happen to me too someday. Maybe I'll ring Bart up, see what I can do about it. So you remain, one remains, you know, duped voluntarily, involuntarily, as if it matters. Duped.
It's a therapy game, really.
Duped by the presentation of mundane consciousness as it's experienced by me. we're duped by that, and that enlightenment or correcting our attitudes or not having thoughts or believing differently about things or applying ourselves diligently or radical Christian love will be the vehicles for me to suck less. And the big end of sucking, as meaning the permanent end of sucking, is, you know, my enlightenment experience.
The permanence is implying time.
Yeah. Well, that comes with, right? The creature somehow committed to time, imposed upon by time, wants resolution and revelation to appear in time and be reliable for the remainder of the, right? The biological sentence. Yeah. No more suffering for me. Har, har, har. I think what made Krishnamurti so radical and therefore indigestible or undigestible was his emphasis on steering away from processes and practices and knowledge to things to do, which clearly reinforces that sense of an individual being committed to do something about the banality of that individual. And so he was very capable, strangely so for that period, you know.
Yeah, really.
On the scale that he spoke, right? It was a big scale. He was strangely capable of entraining his audience, large or small, by dismantling the nature of thought, the nature of becoming, the nature of time, the nature of pattern recognition, and therefore somnambulism. And inviting present wakefulness through the, you could say, cessation of liturgy, practices, and or destinations.
You know, I wonder how many people in his audiences were frantically taking notes, looking for the formula, figuring that they might, assuming they just couldn't quite grasp it, what he was saying.
It was very common amongst people that hung out with him to express a certain kind of frustration or confusion as to what he was getting at.
Because he never seemed to settle on an approach, info, or anything like that.
No.
It was more the opposite, you know.
The emphasis that he made in that talk with Trungpa was absolute stillness of mind, which Trungpa began to question, but Krishnamurti wouldn't permit him to. What he was getting at was that as long as we're embroiled in rumination, universe creation, assignment, mood, sentimentality, right? Creating a storyline from presence. That's a mind that's in motion. That's a mind that's creating time, creating identity, restlessly considering itself, its insufficiencies, and the next novel thing it plans on doing about those insufficiencies. So it can be interviewed by Renata McNay someday. Yeah. Well, so that was his emphasis, was stillness of mind. But again, not he wasn't broadcasting how to get a still mind. And he was clearly dismissing the foolishness of all meditation processes and practices to try to cultivate still mind through, you know, a formulaic,
right,
repetitive kind of process or practice, like procrastinating before you go to work.
Right. Well, it makes a lot of sense. He emphasized a couple times, he kept saying, you know, if you're mimicking anything, you're just remaining locked in a pattern.
Yes.
That's very clear.
Yeah.
If you're mimicking, you're in a pattern.
Right. Yes.
And yeah, yeah. The suggestion was you want to get out of the pattern.
So the stillness of mind that he was referring to, if you were lucky to, you know, feel him, was the stillness of mind that he was able to, let's say, dwell in or project or invite the audience into through his somewhat lengthy monologues, which just turned out to be deconstruction, yeah, right? It was all of them were deconstruction monologues to leave you at, oh, stillness of mind, quality of stillness of mind, so that one could feel, the audience could feel the vitality of their own intelligence, unconditioned intelligence.
You know, it seems that
that was the important part. Because the more the taste you get of that, you let your consciousness somehow, it likes it, it recognizes it, it keeps going back.
Oh, it does, yes.
I think that's the thing, the recognition.
The point is to get a glimpse underneath the words of it.
But there has to be the recognition, and I think you have to start to get really sick and tired of the same old crap.
Yes.
You know, before you start to recognize that it is crap.
Yes.
And that's not the way. And certainly, if you had a lifetime experience of,
yeah,
trying this and trying that and witnessing all these different things, then starting to see a pattern there, that's a big part of the whole ripening process, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We were talking about that before you came in.
Yeah.
Folks that have it down and happy Disney World goers and vacationers, they're not interested in the shit. They think they got it. They got it. Yeah.
Krishnamurti had, you know, by that time that he was talking with Trungpa,
yeah,
had already developed quite a reliable skill at going through the deconstruction process, free associating, because he was quite capable, going through a deconstruction process of whatever was poignant for that conversation,
right,
and then sliding into home plate,
yeah,
right? Sliding into that stillness. And during that particular conversation, when Krishnamurti was kind of emphasizing absolute stillness of mind, you know, Trungpa being a Dzogchen wise guy, to his credit, was just about and did question Krishnamurti that this thing that you're referring to as stillness of mind is, again, you know, a fallacy. It's not necessary, right? Because in the Dzogchen thing, the bright is the bright is the bright, and there's no condition that need be met prior to the recognition of the bright being the bright being the bright. And so Trungpa offered that lunge. But Krishnamurti would not entertain it. And so in a sense, you know, Krishnamurti was monologuing. He could have, maybe the two of them could have gotten some really interesting mileage out of the nature of, you know, a present inquiry.
Yeah.
But Krishnamurti would not. And he was, you know, a bully in that way in his own right, because he was, you know, so good at it for the number of years he was good at it.
Yeah.
He was not going to be derailed from his winning strategy, even in the company of, you know, Trungpa, that he may or may not have respected. You know, you don't really know. So Trungpa couldn't get any purchase on him to go into something that might have really been kind of fascinating, to see these two minds examine, you know, from a Zog Chen and from whatever you call Krishnamurti's approach, which was also kind of a startlement non-dual approach to see where they might have gone with it.
Well, you know, and
the, never took off.
Well, the stillness of mind, as soon as you pin it down and give a description to it, then it kind of loses its impact.
Well, that's just it. I mean, this, you know, this objectifies too fast for us to outwit it.
Yeah.
You can't use mind, which is already the product of objectification, to outwit the miracle of objectification. That's the big dilemma from a, you know, a contemplative point of view, right? You know, you're like, it's not fucking working, let's see.
Yeah.
You know, you can't.
Yeah,
you're already a product of profound and impersonal waves of objectification, thinking then you can apply yourself as an agent or as a clever being to outwit that you know, geometry. You're not gonna.
It's so counter everything. I mean, it's so counter our experience and our upbringing and our education and culture.
Yes.
Our inclinations, our psychological makeup and everything else.
Yeah. But,
you know.
Yep.
To not come up with a structure or a scenario or a lead in.
Right. Stake a claim.
Yeah. There you go. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's also what makes it so difficult for so many people to stay with something, you know?
Yes.
I mean, and like I say, I mean, I don't know, but I'm just guessing that a huge percentage of the Krishnamurti following were by people that were trying to figure it out, trying to nail it down, trying to understand. They knew he was saying something, and they were determined to figure out what it was, but you know.
It appears that, you know, Wayne Lickerman may be more successful at having enlightened students than Krishnamurti was. You know?
Oh, I wonder.
And in this business, you know, conversion is what it's all about. Conversion is what it's all about. Why was everyone flocking to look now to see Papaji? Because they were imagining that some kind of wave or, you know, dam burst of conversions were going on.
Yeah.
That was Gangaji's guru, wasn't it?
Gangaji and Andrew Cohen and a handful of others, yeah. Right.
But, you know, I think, you know, the Krishnamurti phenomenon, I mean, a lot of it was because of this whole upper crust approach. So, you know, going to California, and that was sort of the cool thing to do, you know, to hang with somebody like that. I mean,
yeah. Well, the theosophists were, you know, they were funded by, you know, wealthy European and Indian culture.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dough rolling around in those high society circles where Krishnamurti would speak.
But, you know, it's interesting. People that I feel like really sort of touched down and didn't try to get their message out, so to speak, in the same way and formalize it. And I of course, Nisargadatta, I think of, and Ramahana Maharshi. It seemed to work in an Indian culture. Maybe because they're just more open to that, you know, the idea of just sort of discarding everything. But it seems like in an American, in the Western setting, it's like there has to be something, some building block. And I think Krishnamurti made it because of the coolness factor and because people just thought they were missing it. They had to stay with it long enough to figure it out. But I don't know that the likes of the Indian guys would have ever been able to make it at all, you know, if they were, you know, somehow an American equivalent, you know. I don't know if that's all conjecture.
Yeah, well.
I don't know what's going on right now. I'm so confused.
Yeah.
Cool.
we're playing around with the sociological impact of.
No, I tend to do that.
Internet of popcorn.
Yeah. Well. Oh, is that why you're just talking and talking and talking?
Yeah. Just an excuse.
Uh huh. Delay strategy before you have another treat.
Clearly, this can't be done with the head. It doesn't work. You can watch your head just kind of go in circles. The mind is not the key to this world.
Well, the head, yeah, the head, the mind is accustomed to a certain kind of dopamine experience that it might refer to as some kind of satisfaction, right?
That is what I was thinking. I thought Krishnamurti was referring to stillness of mind. This is how I interpreted what he was saying, as getting outside of mind.
Yes.
That's how I interpreted it.
Yes.
So I didn't think he was creating another formula. I thought he was saying the same thing. Feel this.
Yes.
Get outside.
Yes.
You can't remain in this loop, in this pattern.
Yes.
Of doing shit, meditating, whatever, so you can get somewhere. Deliverance.
Yep.
Pattern.
Yep.
Becoming all wrapped up in a make-believe bullshit thing that the mind is constantly churning out. So you just call it shit and then move, you know, go other places.
That's why he spent the amount of time he spent on very skillful and cogent, articulate dismantling of, you know, the movement of thought, the movement of mind, the movement of pattern, the movement of, you know, psychiatric and psycho-emotional association. So he spent a lot of time deconstructing that by referring to, you know, the species and geopolitical right things and financial things and sorrow and grief and all this cool stuff that, you know, people enjoy.
Well, it seems to be all sort of medi-medi, isn't it? I mean, because it's like you can't really describe it. You can't say, it is this. All you can say is, not this, not that, really, in many various forms.
Yeah. Well, even not this, not that.
That's not even...
Well, I mean, sometimes it can work, you know. I mean, someone can be sitting, you know, on a corner somewhere and do a little neti-neti, either because they've studied it or because it just comes to mind and wake up because, you know... They were supposed to wake up instead of being hit by a bus. Someone else could do neti neti in a cave for more years than we would care to count, and yet
neti neti.
You got neti neti, baby. Yeah, so you're like, what the, you know? It's kind of delightfully infuriating that there's just no causal linearity or circumstantial outcome of applying yourself in a certain way, diligently over decades, with fantastic earnestness and sincerity, that is going to result in anything at all.
It's Govinda and Siddhartha, you know? It's like Siddhartha sort of came through in the end. It's almost like one of these deals, like a study. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the fiction, but it plays a good point there.
Sure.
It's kind of like the person can't manipulate this. It's not possible.
No, because the person's already embroiled in as an in symptom. Mm. Yeah.
And if that's not all you have to work with, that's what you're going to go back to.
Yes. Right. You can go back to, let's just call it, the naked constituents of conscious contact.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Without story.
Yeah.
And if you're, you know, you play with it for a while and you're, let's say, in good company, right? Experienced company. Then conscious contact isn't telling a story. And yet you are on the receiving end of this aliveness, this something or other. And if we learn how to soften that reflex to inhabit conscious contact from the vantage point of gossip, right? Because every story that you tell yourself, everything you got going on, for as long as you've had it going on, is gossip. You're gossiping to yourself as you could say, an organic consequence of conscious contact, the naked constituents of conscious contact. Call it consciousness, call it being. I mean, it doesn't matter. And so this is presenting, and whatever we call the neocortex, which just could be, it really could be made up. You know, I mean, you can open someone's skull and see a brain and put probes on it and talk about, you know, its things and electro-stimulate, and you could say, yeah, the neocortex is where the thought factory is, because you're not creating stories of unsatisfactoriness in the behind brain. Okay, all right, fine. Thank you, Gary. And so this engine of association, of gossip, is running nonstop, outside of the influence of your will, outside of the influence of your preferences.
Seems to have a large power to make you miserable if you're investigating.
Okay, so we can look at the, let's call them common consequences, of being so beguiled by the otherwise impersonal presentation of conscious contact having turned into gossip. Now you're fucked.
All day long.
All fucking day long. Yeah.
Neurosis.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, depending on where you want to take it, you know, conformist reality is psychotic. Neurotic is friendly. You know, that's a euphemism. No, it's psychotic. So if we can, again, without resorting to, you know, explanation or Genesis or gods in the sky or ascended masters, you know, in your enema bag that come and visit you when you cleanse your bowels. Yeah. Then you have what's present. But there's no explanation for what's present. There's no tautology for what's present. There's no explanation or description, cosmically or otherwise, for what's present or that presence itself. That conscious contact is happening. Conscious contact is happening. And the reflex to gossip about it, again, is not happening because you choose or don't choose. And the content that appears in this field of gossip that you experience in your own so-called bubble, again, is kind of what? Designed by whom? Created how? Through conditioning, through DNA, through ancestry, through the Akashic record, through karmic and dharmic consequences, through, you know, take Oprah Winfrey and friends, lessons that we need to learn in the Earth School. You know, sorry, Oprah. I belched in your sneakers. You know, but these metaphors are, you know, I mean, the New Age landscape, right, is what's the word, overflowing with these kinds of metaphors for what the fuck is this and what are we supposed to do with it?
And there's this constantly for closure. And so the
closure, yeah.
This becoming thing and striking a new catchphrase and one that you hear all the
time
is there's a reason for every, you know.
Sure.
Fire.
Sure.
You lost a child or the fire has, whatever.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. God wants you to learn a lesson.
Well, even, yeah, I mean, I was listening to these two interviews today. Don't ask me why. Maybe because it was raining. And I felt like I deserved to suffer.
That's probably it.
This was, Beth brought it to my attention. It was the Bart Marshall and Deborah Westmoreland, enlightenment team being interviewed, in the UK by the McNays, Conscious TV. Whew, man, what a circle jerk. But, you can see that language going where the divine, the anthropomorphized divine, has a plan for you. And you're like, what's that going to cost, baby?
Yeah, I feel like somehow that's like subtle marketing. I don't know why. It's just marketing.
Oh, it's pernicious, yeah.
Funny. Come up with a tagline.
Yeah, the divine has a plan for you. And again, you can see
it. What is it to say? I mean, nobody's going to prove it.
Well, yeah, really, what can you say about it? Yeah.
Words like that are cheap.
Right.
Cheap, easy, and catchy.
Yeah.
Cheap, so you got to sign up for the program.
Uh-huh, yeah. And, so we can do enlightenment intensives.
I'd just be a real loser.
Oof, yeah. Man. It's very difficult, challenging, let's say, to see if you can move away from the hysteria of, for sure, conformist reality, but also the patina of enlightenment speak. The patina of, the non-dualists or the those that have been delivered and the interviewers and the consequences of it and the programs and the solutions that are offered to ameliorate your angst for usually, a good piece of change. And it's so much biographical pablum. We carry this, the inertia of this biographical pablum with us, which is part of the gossip machine, right? That's how you could say we have become familiar with ourselves. The way we think, the way we feel, the way we process shit. Our little spiritual breakthroughs and how we tuck them away like a squirrel with nuts. So we've run out of the wild capacity for present improvisational living or present improvisational being. Because we've listened to so much of this shit for so long that now it's all monkey see, monkey do. And the way that these interviews and, bodies of teachings are languaged continue to reinforce you as a creature in a gossip field. Becoming is very convenient for what some might refer to as, the ego to self-entrap. Because we're so oriented to, you could say, superficial loyalties to the way I feel, the way I think, the way I look, how I'm processing my present experience, whether my future is going to be secure. Right? So this profound wave after wave after wave, iteration after iteration of self-assessment and security seeking within a field of gossip that we hate.
It's totally, like, bizarre, abstract insanity. You're just making shit up.
You're fucking dreaming in situ. You're just making shit up. Moment after moment after moment. And then, and you're so...
For no reason at all.
You're torturing yourself for no reason at all, yes. And you're so exhausted that you don't have the energy to break out of it. So you just throw up your hands and go with it.
Another beer.
Yeah, really. Like, oh, fuck. This just won't quit. Fuck, fuck, fuck. I'll have another. Yeah. Yeah, set me up. Yeah, you know, with a shooter and whatever. And then we place ourselves, you know, again, we reify or reify, depending on how you like that word, so instantaneously, which is that movement of turning conscious contact into a story. Presuming that conscious contact, and therefore I, is it has a durability, duration and durability. Then we're just sick, I mean, somatically sick, if not psychologically and emotionally sick, with time. We become literally sick with or sick from time.
You know, the whole thing seems to me that, and it's funny because outside of here, anybody else would think this is crazy talk, but it seems to me that...
I think it's crazy too.
Yeah, well, I think we probably would. It's a...
I'm hoping it is.
Embracing brainlessness. You know what I mean? It's like everything about the brain, the human brain that creates time out of nothingness.
Yeah.
They create story.
Yeah.
And all of that. It's just sort of being chill with it. Just like,
mm-hmm.
you know, stepping back from it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's going to have its own inertia.
And yes.
It's going to roll along.
Yeah.
But not clinging on to that. Letting it go. And the brain, it seems like it's like going to do what it's going to do. And especially, like I was saying before,
yes.
if you have certain roles to play,
uh-huh.
kind of demanding, then, you know, you, in the back there is somewhere it's like, this is stupid and all that jazz, but it doesn't matter. You're still, you got to finish what you're doing. But it's all brain chatter. And I mean, I really see it as sort of a, physicality, this brain pumping out electrical power all over the place, and all and thoughts arising, and the old thoughts and dream, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, hey, the brain's going to do what the brain's going to do, and that's sort of almost in a way, it's not my business.
Well, yes, you could say over the arc of a discovery process. Let's say we make peace to the best we can, the best we can. We make certain kind of peace with all of this functionality that we thought prior we were either controlling or it was controlling us, or that this, you know, this kind of painful at oddsness that we suffer all the time, right? The nomenclature of self. So yeah, you can come to certain kind of relaxation points, lily pads along the way, where you cut yourself a little slack, cut yourself a break, and then you will discover whether there's still remaining a sense of self as, you know, conduit. As center, as actor, in the midst of right conscious contact. The enlightenment nomenclature that you hear from those that have been delivered is in their own language, you know, the clumsy or articulate way that they're able to, you know, speak it out is let's use the metaphor, the collapse of duality or the collapse of a separate self being at the center of, you know, conscious contact, right? That's a pretty reliable, you know, if you were doing a report, a book report, and you read a bunch, of this shit, you know, not because you were an avid seeker trying to get over your mother issues, but you're getting a good grade. You go, holy fuck, I read all these books, and to a woman, right, to a Mahatma, there's this theme that I find through this, you know, discovery of enlightenment stories, enlightenment biographies, which is the right cessation of doership, the cessation of a separate self. Nothing, or in Gary Weber's case, you know, the absence of thoughts, nothing is processing present experience, which gives rise to the sense of an individual, that you are an individual inhabiting your body. That goes.
And there's certain people that have this condition, evidently, where they don't have a sense of self. They don't have this sense of a body self.
You mean like people in institutions?
Yeah, I mean people that have
that are
some brain mouth
that are interviewed by psychiatrists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But they don't. They report at least.
They're not
reporting it as if it's a spiritual thing. They're just sort of, I mean, from what I read something about a while ago. I can't remember too well.
Could be some clever enlightened folks who are hanging out in the mental institution getting, you know, three hots and a cot.
But it seems like they're just missing some connection.
It could be that. I mean, you know, brain.
That's all this deconstruction thing. That's all like letting the brain go, you know. I mean, they were wired that way, I guess.
Okay. I mean, if you find one, invite them in, you know, with their attending psychiatrist, and we'll talk it through and see how they're feeling about shit.
Answer, you know?
Surgery for some is the answer. Yeah. Part of the dilemma, or a lot of the dilemma, is the confidence, the unconscious, naive confidence that we place in conscious contact, suggesting I me my in a body apart from the whole as a discrete operating or experiential unit. That's the self, the lowercase self, right? The agony of separation, the agony of temporality, the agony of at-riskness. The awkwardness of this extraordinary loneliness that we have. And our a way to mitigate it is usually through one or a million forms of exploitation. And that's why the species is going to shit. Because the common way that we medicate our existential irritability is through exploitation. And that's what Krishnamurti spoke about eloquently, unceasingly, untiringly for, I don't know, 50, 60 years of his life, from the time he was in his 30s or even late 20s to when he died at 90 or 91 years old.
It didn't.
The exploitation has only gotten, you know, more demonic.
Worse.
Yeah.
Even just normal social interactions are by definition exploitive.
Yes.
They are.
Yes.
And when you see it in yourself and then you experience it so frequently in others, it's really hard to just like commit to quote normal social behavior. It's like,
oh yeah.
I'm not interested.
Oh, I know. That's right. I mean, to go ahimsa is to withdraw from exploitation. And boy, that can kick the shit out of you, right, in the context of conformist reality. Yeah. Relations with siblings, relations with parents, relations with partner, relations with bank clerk, relations with, you know, those fuckers at Comcast that ruin everything.
They're trying.
I know they're trying. No, they're turning over a new leaf. This is the pain of it. You see, you start getting unplugged from the repetition of your own failed system. You just can't stand the exploitation anymore. It's a heartbreak. It's a big heartbreak, which is kind of great. I mean, it's a grace of some kind. You know, you could call it a dark night of the soul, depending on how, you know, dramatic you are. I mean, yeah. You know, it could be a dark night of the soul. Could be a 2 second, you know, like, I'm good. You know, let's get on with this. Or it can be months and years and, oh, everything goes, you know, goes south. And it's like, oh, yeah. So I
when it happens every night,
it gets older.
Yeah, that's right. I know. Yeah. Right.
A lot of it's just, it's like giving up the hope that, yeah, I'm going to play that game. I'm going to finally, like, I'm going to...
Yeah.
Just be a real
loser. Yeah. Like I always thought, well, I'll just someday like get in. I can do that. I can just move faster. It's like when the game is really up when you realize you don't want to, and that's why you're not doing it. You never have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or you're just
that's
not.
That's why you're not really even a loser. So it's just funny.
Yeah.
We're given a particular affinity. And you can't necessarily pick that affinity.
Yeah.
And I have an affinity for this, apparently. Much more so than that.
There's, as one withdraws from exploitation, just, you know, through an organic process of living and learning and hanging out and stumbling into weird fucking conversations that make pretty much no sense to anybody. Let's just say your interest in the world or winning in the world necessarily loosens and softens.
It doesn't seem to make as much sense even, like winning. It's like you get a taste of what this really is, and that becomes winning, and that keeps becoming winning. But there does seem to be a back and forth where you kind of want to go back. You're like, No, I can do this again. I can take this winning into that winning and combine them. You know what I mean? It gets a little weird.
Everyone's a chef.
Yeah. You want to pick it up somehow. I'll just combine those two.
It's got to serve me in the real world somehow.
Yeah. Okay, 10% of that and 90% of this. And so, you know, it just seems to kind of be that way. And
yes.
Kind of see, like, no, this is winning. The felt sense of what this is totally winning, off the charts winning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So much better and more winning. So it's like whatever, you know.
So I don't hear winning anymore. I hear winning.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You know, you're really fucked when, like, favorite ways of sort of running and exploiting don't work anymore. It's like you try, you go there.
You can't get any mileage.
It's just you can't get it up. You know, it's like
when
you get the shoe warehouse, it just didn't.
Yeah.
I'm like, let me out of the third quarter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So I just walked around the mall, looked around, then I went to Costco and bought food.
Yeah, right. But I thought I might have a shopping hole, but it just didn't go my way.
Well, this is more organic thing. That's what. Yeah. You keep going back to this. You're like, this orgasm's way better. I'm just gonna keep going there. You know?
I think so.
You're
it
like,
turns out to be where's the best O?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a dopamine thing. Where's the best O? Let's see. DSW. Not today. No. Really?
Well, I've said it before that our Chrome comic where the woman's. The guy's looking out the window and the woman's looking at the TV or something. And she says, should I change the channel? And he goes, oh, why bother?
Yep.
It's your dog in his socket.
That's the way it seems to be in so many things, whether it's DSW or whatever.
Yes.
And it's like, whatever.
We're magical. We feed on novelty and puzzle solving and what's unpredictable. That's how we're built, you could say. That's how we thrive. Novelty, unpredictability, elasticity, problem or puzzle solving, that really, right, opens up the gates of serotonin and dopamine and thrill and frees us from the banality of exploitation and frees us from the banality of security seeking.
It's funny because the other day I was walking and I had this puzzle analogy going on. It was kind of ridiculous. It was really drawn out. It was not a long walk. But it was sort of that. But I felt like it was, the analogy was more like, it's like you get stuck in one puzzle. Like, we think we're in just one puzzle, and then we just keep taking it apart,
yeah,
putting it back together, and then we're, like, frustrated, because that's really boring, to be with the same puzzle,
yeah,
over and over and over, and you can't get anywhere. It's just rearranged, and you're like, ah, that didn't work, and then you take it apart again.
Right.
It seems like this process is kind of like just realizing, like, there's other puzzle, like, there's other modes where you can do that same thing in some way in an expanded manner besides get that same puzzle that you just keep taking apart.
Yes. Together. Yeah.
And then you can come back to that if you want, but it's all just the fun of, yeah, like a giant jigsaw game puzzle.
Yeah. Silence of being. Doesn't have to be accompanied by absence of thoughts. You can't turn the volume down on conscious contact. Maybe with heroin. For a time. Yeah. So it's...
Well, it's up with a vengeance when you end up with the hangman.
Yeah, I don't think it really does necessarily because you sleep and that's conscious cotton. Yeah. It's not really... Yeah, I mean, right, it's...
Yeah, unless it shuts down your autonomic nervous system and they find you dead in the morning.
Yes.
That's the heroin win.
That's the heroin win.
Yeah, really. I took this fucker out.
But you just pop into another universe and you're like...
Yeah, you see, it's like, yeah, no. We're just going to keep bothering you with shit.
Yeah. I get heroin in this universe.
What's the heroin equivalent?
Yeah, really. Hello, knock, knock. What's the heroin equivalent in your universe? Oh, please come in.
You're a baby. Oh, can my mom do heroin? And then breastfeed me.
It, yep, it can go that way. It's gruesome.
There's nothing sacred here. No.
When we're in, you know, a certain kind of, let's call it spiritual fixity, the habit is to get relief from a thing or add to my experience as some form of amelioration. That's the reflex. That's the exploitation. And we do this on a very intimate scale within ourselves or with each other or on a grand scale if you happen to be, you know, a player in the military, industrial, banking, you know, 1% cartel, right, or employed by them, like we all are, yeah, right. So the remedy well, see, once you articulate a thing, right, you've already created a boundary field in which you are appearing or operating And then the myth that you can or should apply yourself in a certain way for whatever, spiritual succor or enlightenment if you're, you know, to infinity and beyond, if you're that kind of guy or gal. What if there's a back door? What if there's like a secret, silly password way behind 1,000 years of encryption? Because as long as we process this weirdness through 1,000, if not 10,000, if not 100,000 years of encryption, then we just keep ending up in that sorrow field of exploitation. And pride, you know, hubris and pride and exploitation. Because we can't crack the encryption.
You're in the same pattern or like the same little puzzle, or like, yep, if you're thinking of a fractal, you're just in one tiny little bit of the fractal. But you, yep, can actually move about the whole fractal, not just this one little piece.
Yeah,
I have this image of IKEA. In IKEA, you're like a rat in a maze. you're just following the path of the crowd, going through everything in you.
The only way to get back to your car is through the cash register and the chocolate.
Yeah, that's right. But really,
you're only a
few feet away from the exit path. You just have to know where it is.
That's right.
You have to be able to look from above.
Yeah, there you go.
Whatever,
that's
know?
Right. Yeah, you have to. You can't go through.
The employees know how to do it.
You can't go through the encryption field. Somehow you have to figure out, you have to feel your way to check this out and see whether it's actually been successful at imposing all of this gossip upon you or not. While we experience the gossip field as real, then we're locked out behind the encryption field. It turns out being, whatever that is, has a signature. Present experience has a curious, irrefutable signature.
It's always here, but it's pretty easy to not, like, focus on it. Like, your attention can be in lots of different directions, but when it's suggested that you say, you know, just by you bringing it up, it's like,
yeah, that's the password. That's the idiot password that goes through the back door.
That's easy to miss because it's so always here and feels so much just normal.
Yeah, we have habituated to, let's say, the primary miracle and got stuck by the inorganic beings within a field of gossip. And therefore we writhe in unsatisfactoriness and exploitation through pretty much the whole trip, with an occasional trip to Costco or DSW or, you know, something like that. We find our way back, not that we ever left it, we just were, you could say, you know, confused, right? Being takes itself for granted, and then attention or awareness, instead of abiding in itself, gets snookered into a gossip field. You know, maybe that's what Krishnamurti was referring to as stillness of mind, is withdrawing from the entanglement with the gossip field, right, with space, time, and implication, with exploitation and becoming. And just chills back. You don't have to make a claim, stake a claim. Be smarter than the next enlightened bozo. You don't have to become biographical. Because no one really gives a shit about what happened to you. They only give a shit about what's happening or happened to them. So why go all biographical on it? I mean, it's a real cheap thrill.
Just for you, yeah.
It's like, oh, well, I remember sitting on a swing, and then I was, oh, then I ran into a person, and then I found myself in India, you know, in a rice paddy village with cobras and hyenas and monkeys, strange people wearing orange clothing, burning weird smelling fires, and I always thought someday I want to be just like this, not. I'm sorry, can someone take me to the airport? Really nice meeting all you folks. Yeah.
There's groups that get together, like I've been thinking of the dream group that happens back at the friends. I have never gone to it, but I can imagine that it's. But it's because I've heard some of the people, and I think it's very much that. It's trying to get in touch with their past lives, future lives, or whatever that.
All of which is just, you know, more fanciful distraction in the gossip field.
You can find lots of antidynamism.
That, you know, what? That's all. It's all you can find.
Yeah, it's pretty much all you can find. It's weird.
Yeah.
It seems just like a. It's a very simplified version of it, obviously, but it does seem like just a societal construct, gossip field, and everyone just stays in that little, like if you were just partitioning out the landscape or something, and someone suggested one spot was really important, and everyone was like, oh yeah, and started clamoring around it, and then seemingly it just got stuck there.
It's like that video game, To Build a Zoo.
To Build a Zoo.
Zoo Tycoon. That's what we have.
What is this? You build a zoo?
Yeah, zoo Tycoon. But there are other ones that are even you know, bigger than that. Like you become God. I mean, there are games where you create civilization. Fuck the zoo.
All the Sims. All the Sims stuff.
Yeah, all the Sims stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have here. Build a zoo. Zoo Tycoon. The whole fucking planet. It's just Zoo Tycoon.
I like Gangaji's description or reference to it as the cult of society.
Yeah.
You know, it's a pretty strong cult.
Yeah.
War is bad.
Apparently not.
Helping others is good. Recycling is good. You know?
Do yoga so that you can kiss your ass goodbye.
You can reach it while you're
Master, why should we do yoga? So you can kiss your ass goodbye. Get out. Any kind of salve so easily becomes another object, something to cling to, something to defend. Any kind of salve.
Well, yeah, even if you turn the society thing into, like, whatever that Ganji thing I was just getting, then that's, like, there's like society, and then there's like some other.
Yeah.
Like you've created another.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you have. Look at the culture of enlightened beings, the proliferation of enlightened beings in the so-called West. Mm-hmm. You know, through the, you know, great experiment of the democratizing internet. And that's the answer. The answer to the ills of society, the cult of society has become the cult of the enlightened. I mean, I can't wait to go to Newman's next, you know, Kirtan. Newman.
Well, or it was the cult of, you know, hippies and drugs. Like, there's always some counterculture. It's counter. It's all counter to something that you've already assumed is relevant. You've turned it into an idea, and now you have a counterculture.
That's right.
Oh, great. Another fucking counter to another book. There are counters to another counter.
I mean, when you look at like, Krishnamurti's whole thing, or Terence McKenna's thing, or Ram Dass's thing, or Neem Karoli Baba's thing, or Ramakrishna's thing, or Nir Sagadatta's thing, what we have are these, you know, kind of little pockets of counterculture.
Yeah.
And that seems to persist, you know, and been obviously successfully mercantilized by Byron Katie and Ajashanti and other big name gurus that are just fucking rolling in green and helping tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people through social media and webcasts and multi-level marketing schemes where they enlighten or they certify other people, right? And that's the counterculture. That's the fucking counterculture.
Totally.
Is going to an Adyashanti retreat. Fucking put a needle in my eye.
I forget where.
That's it.
They've just taken that system and redesigned it. Basically.
Yes.
They took the first system and redesigned it and called it.
That's right. But basically,
that's
you're saying
about that thing in that puzzle. You just keep taking
it
apart.
It's all entrepreneurship.
You put it together and it looks different, but it's the same fucking
it's
puzzle.
It's the same. It's
same
all.
Pieces.
It's all entrepreneurship. It's like, you know, fuck you. I don't like the way you make money. I'm going to make money this way. That's the counterculture? Byron Katie's the counterculture?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Oprah Winfrey's the counterculture? I don't think so.
She's the worst. That lady.
I remember her fabulous at 50 thing.
Oh, God. She's the worst. Oh, she can't. It's just all about money and marketing and success. And
it's not time to try the words.
Well, I ate too much pizza there.
Ooh, the pizza sounds good. I mean, Bat Gap and Conscious TV, that's the counterculture? The East Bay Open Circle, that's the counterculture?
Just thinking about the dude I met there. He was really fried. I think he was actually fried on seeing too many spiritual teachers.
It can happen.
Like he had that aura of somebody that like maybe did too many drugs, but it might have been just he did one too many spiritual teachers.
Yeah.
Do I have that aura?
Just some guy that I met in California when I was out at the Open Secret.
We have matching auras, me and that guy.
Yeah, I mean this cool fellow from Europe, what's his name? Boren Oakland or something. He wrote this cool book, more or less dismantling reality. You know, very much you could say in the same vein that Peter Brown likes to articulate the yoga of radiant presence.
You mean incomprehensibly?
Yeah, yes, incomprehensibly. Dismantling what conformist reality is, you know, through the physicist's eyes and these eyes and these eyes, and I mean, really, you know, woof, taking it down. Mm-hmm. And then he has a Facebook group, which is by kind of invitation, you know. Can I join? I really like this stuff.
Really?
You know, then they let you in.
Oh, God, it's by invitation?
Yeah.
I don't want just anything.
It's a, you know, I mean, it's a private Facebook group club dedicated to, I guess, his teachings and or discussions of this book and the implications of it.
All right, I'm trying to be open-minded.
Go ahead. And then you see everyone has forgotten about the truth, and they're just discussing the book.
That's what you get when there's something by invocation. You have to be invited. Yeah.
And then you know, comments about I don't know
Did they get a ring?
The rhythms of their enlightenment was their pre and post enlightenment was. Wait, the reason of the book was to flatline.
Well, is the author part of this group? Is he the leader of this group, or is
he's there? He comments on people's questions and things.
See, it seems to me the leaders, if you want to call them, you know, they come up with this inspired way of presenting something.
Yeah.
And then before they
ask four questions, turn it around,
sucked back into this whirlwind of attention. I mean, I think of Eckhart Tolle, of course.
There you go. Eckhart Tolle, he's the counterculture, Eckhart Tolle.
That's one of the best examples for Jesus, you know, or
well, he was for a short time, but they took care of that.
Any number that they, you know, all of a sudden, boom, there's this structure built around it.
That's right.
Well, people are just on the lookout, seemingly, for anything they can turn into a secret club that they can then turn into a gossip field that only they're included. Like, they're cool, and they understand this book, and
it's Zoop Tycoon.
That's what they do, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And see, the focus becomes.
You think that the teacher.
Once again, on the materiality of the so-called teaching, mm-hmm. So it becomes a field of agreement and disagreement and discovery, and what would so-and-so say and what would so-and-so say. And it's like, you see, the gossip field is taken over again. The gossip field jumps right in. It was a joke Krishnamurti used to tell, you know. We've shared it a few times. It's silly, but, you know, someone runs to Beelzebub and says, you know, master, they've got a new religion on earth. You know, that could be the end of, you know, our reign of darkness. He says, don't worry, I'll help them organize it.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Right? And so we see the gossip field, the reflex for objectification and materialization to come in all the time, inexhaustibly. No matter what you got going on, it's going to sneak up on you. And while you're off being proud for a moment, bam, it's got you, and it's gonna organize you. Yeah.
Organized, repackaged.
And even in a, you know, I would say kind of a useful, provocative work that dismantles the way that we process reality, the outcome of that, if you take it all the way home, is. Chocolate milk, anyone? You know, nothing at all. But obviously the discussion group, again, right, fetishizes the whole body of work. And you lose the, you lose the release. You lose the release.
I have to check this dismantling reality, right?
Beth is a member of the group, so if I don't get it right, you can email her and she'll tell you. I did email him after I, you know, saw a little video or something, and I asked him if he would, you know, be willing to like Skype with the Night Sky's Sangha. He said, "I'll pass." I'm like, but we need you, you know. I'll pass.
Your reputation has gotten around.
I don't have a reputation. How could I possibly have a reputation? What? Gary Weber said to his wife, that fucking asshole, that's my reputation?
Well, now probably that old song over there. Who knows?
Well, that's okay. Who knows? You know, I didn't include Dale in any of that, you know, repartee. I mean, you give as a compassionate act, and I'm not saying I'm compassionate, and I'm not, but as a compassionate act, you know, you interface with someone. Let's say you're a little released from exploitation, so you're a little more playful, you're a little more impish, because you're not stuck in, right, an exploitive relationship either internally or with somebody else. So you give, let's say you nudge someone a little bit, and you kind of give them the opportunity to tell the truth. just to see whether they're still defended, you know, what they got going on, what they're clinging to, holding on to, how they're compromising their own freedom and or the freedom of their students because they're, right, they got a package going on. So you interface a little bit and you nudge them a little bit and you challenge them a little bit because you can sniff that shit out. And you give someone an opportunity, you create an opportunity to make a friend where someone can tell the truth about, you know, anything that might still be binding upon them. And it's okay if it's binding, but there's a certain kind of release that can occur if you can just be fucking, I don't know, honest about it. No, I'm afraid because of this, or I'm intimidated because of that, or I don't trust this. You know, just to say something that might be true about how you're feeling about a situation instead of hiding behind all kinds of hyperbole and lame excuses, which just keeps you, right, in that field of exploitation because you just can't come clean.
Well, there's still fear at the bottom of it all.
There you go. There is. There's fear at the bottom of it all. There's reputation at the bottom of it all. There's being recognized and or, you know, applauded as an enlightened person, being capable of helping other people to become enlightened or to help them with their PTSD or other disagreements,
you know,
in life.
The other thing is language. You know, I mean, we speak in whatever colorful way we choose to speak, but it just seems like the bulk of society is pretty guarded and that. There are certain things you just wouldn't say, or it will be automatically construed as a hit job, you know?
Yeah. Well, sure. Yeah. And so, conformist reality, by its nature, is guarded. It has to be.
It's pretty fucking boring.
Isn't it?
I had this big rapping thing at work for this, you know, charity thing at work, and I'm standing there next to a guy that's in sort of upper management rapping some stuff, and I'm like, hey, you know, if your wife starts handing you packages with the, you know, your name and then 4G on it, you better really wonder where she's getting her stuff from, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No acknowledgement. Like, and I talked out a couple zingers. Nothing.
Nothing.
Like,
yeah.
I finished rapping and went away.
I know.
It was just fucking boring.
Nobody really wants to be touched by life.
Just gentle off-color comments didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. You couldn't get a party going.
I just look at you like,
Just get a blank stare, and then the next thing comes. So, how about that golf game?
Yeah.
Well, everyone is so
off-color.
Everyone is so intimacy disordered, yeah. And so guarded, and you know, even though, you know, so-called human to human, there's a huge amount of energy and a huge amount of playfulness,
yeah,
and a huge amount of, you know, sensuality that doesn't have to be consummated, but, you know, because that could be really tiring. But I mean, like, you know, I mean, dolphins, they just fuck each other all day and all night, and they don't care who they're getting entangled with. Could be a man with a man or a woman with a woman. I mean, they're just like, yeah, let's do this. You know, let's eat some fish and fool around. But we don't do that. But we're built the same way. Really, let's eat some fish and fool around. So in order to be, you know, have a so-called reliable social order, we have to repress and suppress our natural, yeah, effusive, playful dopamine natures. And that, as you can see, as that suppression occurs amongst the human scale, then it just turns into exploitation. Yeah. Or it, you know, it's out of hand, and the amount of, you know, non-consenting, right, violence is epidemic,
that's
right?
Where, yeah, I'm sort of an outlet for I've been exploited for too long.
Non-consenting, you know, activity is epidemic in the, you know, across the whole species. You know, it's not just the Catholic Church that has a lock on that shit. So we're very, I mean, we're strange. I mean, we are absolutely ecstatic by nature, playful and crazed and improvisational, solving puzzles, fooling around, having the next piece of fish. You know, that's where we actually thrive, but fortunately or unfortunately, you know, within the context of conformist reality, it is a repression algorithm. And even within all of these fucking spiritual circles, maybe Osho was in a, you know, was an exception. Maybe that was an exception. But in most of all of these spiritual circles, you know, this enlightenment dance as some kind of deliverance from all of this repression is another form of repression. It becomes another form of repression. It becomes another form of envy and angst and becoming. It's so sad. And Osho's thing didn't work out so well either. I mean, everybody was fucking everybody. Oh, you know, one day you had a neck massage, the next minute you were like, you know, in an orgy of some kind. You know, whether that was in Pune or obviously when things got exciting in Oregon, there was enough juice there. I mean, Osho was so hypnotic and so powerful in his own right that he was able to attract tons and tons of creative, powerful humans that created a city out in the middle of fucking Oregon that became larger and, you know, financially had a greater, you know, GDP or GNP than
the city that they invaded.
Yeah. I mean that's fascinating. And with the Rolls Royces, you know, and the whole shebang.
Yeah, it was a little over the top.
But that was a kind of another curious experiment, another kind of exploitation, right? Another kind of indulgence.
We'll have to be careful not to go that far.
Yeah.
We all have to be real careful. I mean,
we'll have to
line, so close right? to that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I know. So we're up against some, you could call them somewhat formidable forces that few people are even conscious of. Or can articulate, or are willing to learn about, or study.
Oh, that's for sure.
You know, to look at the fascinating inculcation or inoculation of an otherwise very playful species, like our dolphin friends, that became Zoot Tycoon, dwelling in repression and exploitation. And even most of these spiritual circles, you know, kind of repeat that, unfortunately, but okay.
Pretty much everything.
Yeah. So you have to figure out, we're not, I don't know, how to chill out. I mean, it's an incredible challenge to see if you can find a way to feast, literally feast, on your own present experience without accoutrement. Calling that enlightenment seems so foolish. Or coming up with biographical references to when, you know, you were released from seeking. Just, you know, sounds like blowing chunks. It's got to be something cooler than that. Because that's just not cool anymore. Well, at least, you know, from a point of view, it's not cool anymore to go all biographical on your so-called enlightenment experiences, and then become a celebrity or exploit people, you know, through their vulnerability and angst, take their money and make promises to them. Give me a break. Come on. Come on. Oh, well. And few people are, you know, interested in, call it kind of an intimacy that gets created when we're not exploiting each other. Because if we're not exploiting each other,
we don't know what to do.
We don't know what to do. right? If we're not exploiting each other.
Or just at least hanging out in that gossip field.
Or hanging out in the gossip field.
Me, or I'm gossiping about other people. Or telling about something
yes,
in the gossip field.
Telling biographical stories or making or staking claims on our own experience or what enlightenment is or isn't. We get really uncomfortable. And that's fun to play with because this is, if it's anything, it's crushingly intimate. But not between persons necessarily. Right? It's intimate as a waveform.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's just intimacy.
Yes. Yeah.
It's dense.
Dense with intimacy, dense with that kind of profundity, dense with, you could say, care and affection. That is, you know, transcends the storyline of the malnourished person. Our intimacy is really joyful and playful. It doesn't have to be demonstrative. It's remarkable how potent it is just being chill and still. Wow. And I don't hear this invitation to intimacy coming from the bozo fuckers that end up on those interview programs.
I don't know where I hear it other than here. There must be somewhere. Right? I mean, there must be something.
This can't be that special. But that's really what we're doing. We're engaging in an egalitarian quality or adventure, shamanic enterprise of absolute intimacy, which has nothing to do with biographical one-upmanship.
But people will see it as danger. I mean, they
well,
see...
clearly they're not flocking.
They see danger written all over it, you know.
Well, that's...
their, it is danger.
They're right. It is.
They're right.
It is. It, danger is written all over it. It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. To be willing to discover what it might like, what it might feel like to rid yourself of exploitation, rid yourself of defensiveness and accusation, like our dear enlightened friend Gary. You know, to take it on the chin and reply with affection without, you know, challenge or wound. You know, just take it on the chin and love anyway. See if you can cultivate that instead of, what, slides and fucking silly little spiritual exercises and...
The ranking of enlightenment.
The ranking of enlightenment.
Sexual experience and psychedelics.
Yeah.
Really? They were on equal footing.
No. Saying? No, the enlightenment is
higher.
Sexual is, I think, 8, and psychedelics is 9, or something like that.
I like to combine all 3.
Yeah.
People
yeah,
possible.
You get 27.
Is there a buffet in town?
Let's go for it.
Oh, God. It's midline people take
really?
Psychedelics. And have an orgasm.
Gobble some mushrooms.
There you go, man.
Do a little, you know, do a little reach around and then wake up.
Do a little coding.
Yeah, truly. Let's do an enlightenment intensive. No, let's not. Let's not do that. Let's just not do that. Like, as in ever again.
It seems like that's so, like, person land. Like, yeah. Like that is very much a sort of, like, we evolved from apes and we're, like, higher primitive or higher, you know, primates. And so these are our accomplishments. And in those terms, it might look really great. But in terms of, like, transcendental Blissfield. That actually is. It's like the most ridiculous thing.
Yeah, it's more grasping than
that. It's just so funny.
Jamie, are you saying you didn't enjoy your Saturday with Gary?
No, I did. I did. Yeah. I'm okay. I mean, I seem to have a little more.
I'm okay.
I seem to have a little more tolerance.
You're right.
I don't expect much from people. And he didn't disappoint in that regard.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, not expecting much.
Yeah, he didn't offer much, so we were good.
You know, I like how you put that.
You have a certain curiosity, and you know, the curiosity about this whole new product, which is not a new idea at all. I mean,
not at all new. Yeah.
You know, that's like a. But he was so scientific about it. And I just wanted to see where that was all sort of coming from.
Yeah.
But then it degraded into a lot of personal stuff from the audience members. And
that's Clearwater, baby.
Yeah. Jeez,
that's the entire human race.
Yeah.
So there was
giant baby syndrome is very very prevalent.
Catharsis and
king baby. Yeah.
Oh, king baby. Oh my god.
Psychological terms.
Yeah.
Okay.
Really, and it doesn't. King baby syndrome spreads across every race, the richest of the rich and the poor of the poor.
I haven't heard that.
So clearly, it has no you know what I mean. You can't win king baby. Even if you get a lot of money and everything's going your way.
No, you're gonna.
Baby syndrome is there.
You're gonna suck for the long haul.
Yeah, it's just funny.
I'm going to take some multiplex home. Have a ridiculous
Those are really good. You should have one of those, Jeff. They look like they would be helpful.